Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, what are the rules and regulations when it comes to drones? We'll take a deep dive and explore it all. I'll chat to the Irish innovator who's created a jelly battery, and as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can drop me an email at any stage. The email address is techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. But let's jump into the world of drones, because it's been a while since we have spoken about drones on this programme in the past. Luca Fuelon has been on talking about the best drones for hobbyists. We've talked about the GDPR and data protection implications of using drones. But I am delighted to say that Fergal McCarthy, who is the chief drone pilot at Drone Services Ireland, is with me now to walk through where we are as of today when it comes to rules, regulations, do's and don'ts. Fergal, I'm delighted to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining me. Drones have gone through different iterations in the last number of years, from, you know, an individual who might want to just do it for the crack, right up to commercial operators building entire business models around them. When it comes to drones in Ireland, is it easy to put them into categories as to when, where and why they're being used?
It can be. There's certainly a couple of different categories that you could put them into. There's obviously the hobbyists, and they'd be just purely for recreational purposes. There's the commercial operators like myself, but there's also another group kind of in between that do it as a sideline gig or just as an addition. And I suppose the regulation changes in the last few years have allowed for that, where you can operate commercially with more freedom now than you could have in the past. The distinction between commercial and hobbyists has been taken away, so you're kind of all seen as one. So you do have a lot of hobbyists that will do certain jobs where they can on the side, like photographs and more stuff like that. And it's them doing something that they enjoy as a hobby and are able to make some money, claw back the cost of the drone, keep upgrading the drones. They are expensive. It's an expensive enough hobby to get started with. So you can understand why people do want to make back that money.
Okay, so let's start with the hobbyist if we can, and then sort of work our way up to the different operators and the different scenarios that you've painted for us there. From a hobbyist point of view, it seems like you can buy a drone for, say, you know, 40 or 50 quid right up to maybe 500 quid, if not more, and use it to capture photographs of maybe your dog on the beach or whatever it might be. What does that person need to know from a regulation point of view, as well as a responsibility point of view, and then the difference between the 20 to 50 quid drone and the 500 quid drone?
Okay, well, you're not probably going to get too many pictures with a 20 quid drone. A lot of those won't have cameras, and even my kids have one. They got it as a present. It's classed as a toy, so it doesn't need to be registered. And that would go for something in where you would go into a toy store and you'll pick it up there. Generally, they don't have cameras. They're very light. They're actually extremely hard to fly because they don't have the technology inside them. They're much harder to fly than the smallest DJI drones, because you're constantly fighting the controls. It doesn't have stabilization. So that will be one thing. You do need to do a bit of research. It might end up being a false economy because you'll buy it and then realize, well, I can't fly it. It's very difficult. One of my kids bounced it off the roof of the kitchen and you can't really bring them outside because they're too light. They don't need any licensing or anything. They don't have a camera. When you buy something, regardless of the weight, if it has a camera, you have to register as an operator with the IAA, through the MySRS system. And that's the first place you probably need to look. Another thing that people often overlook is where they live and where they're going to use the drone. If you're in a built-up area like Dublin in particular, where there is an airport or there's airfields around you, a lot of people buy drones, then they'll be on the Facebook groups and go, "Oh, I didn't actually realize I couldn't fly it in my back garden because something Baldonnel or one of the other airfields that they haven't considered might be too close to them." So there is a bit of research, particularly if you're going to spend hundreds of euro, you're better off doing the research in advance. The simple answer is if it has a camera, you're going to have to register. So that's the first thing you should be doing probably before you even consider it. You don't have to put the drone details in. You're registering yourself as an operator with the regulator. And then the second thing is look online. There's a lot of Facebook groups. People are more than happy to help, particularly hobbyists who are new to the industry. And there are some very good tools, maps that are interactive and will show you the restrictions of where you can and can't fly.
Okay, so the distinction between the drone with the camera and the drone without a camera is obviously an important one. As you said, if it does have a camera, you have to register it. If you buy a drone with a camera and you register it, what's the, like, is there a fast and hard rule when it comes to using it in a residential area, for example, or are you allowed to fly it over your local park? Like, where is the line when it comes to that sort of stuff?
The weight of the drone will determine where you can and can't fly it. Now, a lot of the restrictions are going to be more around data privacy and GDPR probably than aviation. Most people will go for the most common drone on the market at the minute will be the DJI Mini series that are sub 250, are the easiest to operate, the least restrictive in where you can operate it. You can, apart from assemblies of people, such as at a stadium or that, there isn't many restrictions apart from airspace. And if you're near the airport, there isn't many restrictions around operating near people. You can fly them very close to people, they're deemed low risk. And that's obviously why they're so popular with hobbyists. They're also the cheapest entry point in to the market for a good quality drone.
Okay, yeah, and I suppose it's worth mentioning the Data Protection Commission here. I know that they do have guidance and thoughts around drone use and so on. So, as you said, from a data protection point of view, from a privacy point of view, it's worth maybe using those guidelines as well as a healthy dose of Cop On as a reference point as well.
Yes, absolutely. You do have to consider if you're out with a drone, it's not the same as having a ground-based camera. You can get views that you can't get with a if you're a ground-based photographer. You're not going to be able to see over someone's back garden wall or that. So you do need to apply a level of Cop On. And I don't suppose there's anyone here that would want a drone, particularly hovering, looking at their children, looking at their garden. So it does need a level of common sense to be applied to it. If you are near residential areas, don't be hovering over someone's garden. You're just going to make them paranoid that either you're checking them out or scoping them. I got a call last week from a person down in Greystones, I think they were, and there was a drone came up to within 1 meter of her balcony
Oh,
in
wow.
an apartment complex, and she was very concerned because it was hovering there, and she felt it was looking in her apartment. So obviously, if something's going to come that close to it, there may be other nefarious intentions, or it could just be someone practicing, learning, but they need to be cognizant of the fact that that is someone's home, and it's not something you should be doing. And you're going to quickly end up in trouble if you're doing things like that, even accidentally.
Yeah, so let's talk about that then, right? So somebody has gone out, they've bought the drone, they've registered the drone, and they're now flying the drone. But in the instance of that woman in Greystones, like, how does one go about complaining about drone use? And how is it possible for the powers that be to work out, well, it's actually Jess Kelly with the drone in Greystones being a nuisance? Like, how can they bring it back to who is responsible?
Yeah, there's a couple of challenges here. The first place to go is you would start with the Gardaí. If it's that close to your property and you're concerned, definitely go talk to the Gardaí. There are new requirements for drones to broadcast the operator ID. So for myself as a licensed operator, I have to be basically putting out a signal that is a digital signal of my operator registration. The challenge here is, and I've raised this, the mini class drones, the sub 250, are exempt. You don't have to broadcast that. So the idea being that someone with a phone can use a drone scanner app, look up that registration number and go, okay, well, that's this person. They're not going to get anything from that. It's just a 16 digit number, but they could go to the guards and say, look, this person is hovering outside. But again, to me, the problem is when you exclude certain classes out of this direct remote ID program, that's where people are going to use that. Not that they're probably going to broadcast it if their intentions are nefarious, but you are meant to be able to look up that operator or get that operator ID and go to the authorities or the IAA and say, this person was doing this. But again, the C0 class sub 250 are exempt from that requirement in the EU.
Okay, well, that is good to know. We might come back to that in a second, but that's broadly speaking where we're at in terms of the hobbyists. Once you're stepping up to people who are using drones for commercial reasons, so be that a photographer, like a wedding photographer or something like that, right up to drone deliveries and so on, what's the story with regulation, licensing, tracking, and all of that stuff?
Okay, so there was a change at the start of this year, in terms of the types of drones you can use. The European C class identified drones. So the as I said, the Mini is a C0. It's the lowest risk. Then there's C1, 2, 3, and 4. So they're based on the size and risk of the drone. Another popular drone will be the Mavic 3 series. So they fall between two classes of C1 and C2. That determines, and that's also based on the weight, it determines where you can operate it. So if you have a C0 or C1 class drone and you're a wedding photographer, that's the sort of drone you should be looking to purchase because it has the least restrictions in terms of how close you can get to people. You obviously, if you're a wedding photographer, you don't want to be 100 meters away trying to take a picture. And that, with the introduction of that class of drones, older drones like the Mavic 2 Pro, the Phantom 4 Pro, which would have been very, very popular back 4 or 5 years ago, they have moved into a legacy class and you are required now to be 150 meters away from people. So if you were a wedding photographer with a Phantom 4 and you're trying to get as much out of it as possible, technically you have to be 150 meters away from people and built up areas. So that is going to define where for commercial, it also is relevant to hobbyists, but that classification determines where you can and can't operate your drone. and how close to people you can get.
Yeah, and we've seen quite a bit in terms of the drone delivery services. We've had Bobby Healy on this program in recent months talking about Mana Drones. Just give us a bit of a guide and a bit of a walk through how they're being used almost as commercial vehicles in some instances, and the other types of commercial services that are available via drone.
Yeah, well, they get a lot of publicity. They are seen as the hot topic at the minute. There is obviously Bobby's Mana drone deliveries in Blanchardstown at the minute. Wing are also doing a trial in South Dublin, so they would be probably the best known. They're getting the recognition. You've medical deliveries on one hand with Wing, and food deliveries on the other hand with Bobby. A lot of people, that's probably where a lot of people see drones as because they get the publicity, but there's so many other use cases where drones are taking people out of harm's way, be it search and rescue, where the thermal cameras and that are saving people's lives in dangerous environments like construction, quarrying, land surveying, large areas. Drones come to the forefront there because, say, for example, you have a bog that you need to survey. It's a very dangerous place to operate. And if you try to do that with traditional methods, there's only certain areas of the land you can actually walk on. So you can only basically survey where there is a hard road, essentially. Drones can cover that whole area and get you the information. The same with quarries, that you're not down in the pit with dangerous machinery and that. So there's huge potential for drones to save lives, to take people out of danger, to do inspection work on bigger buildings, things like that. There's also now a new operator washing buildings in Ireland with a drone. So he's obviously targeting high-rise apartments in Ireland aren't very high, but still apartment blocks where the drone will go up and down the building and spray it, window cleaning and things like that. So there's massive potential in the industry. It's just obviously a lot of people focus on the delivery side of it because that's what's in the media so much.
Yeah, and look, it's definitely important to focus on those other solutions that you've mentioned, things like the surveying of land, the use in agricultural settings. That's all vital services that not only can save time because it's much more efficient as a way of doing things, but as you said, it can keep people out of harm's way. Are drones going to become more affordable? And if someone is listening to this now and they have acres of land and they'd love to use a drone, how easy is it to get comfortable with the responsible level of drone piloting that would be required?
Yeah, certainly the affordability, they've definitely become far more affordable. The technology that the big manufacturers are getting into small drones now is phenomenal, where the same drone I have now that can do a surveying job was four or five, nearly 10 times the size 3 or 4 years ago. So that has also brought down the affordability, and you can see different types of sensors now being packed into a small 1 kilo drone. So the advancements in technology through miniaturization has definitely moved this forward, made it more attainable for the likes of the farmers to be able to survey their land with a multispectral camera, which isn't just giving them a pretty picture, it's giving them where they need to target, where they need to spray. It also means they don't need to spray a whole field. They can survey a field very quickly and go, oh, there's 5 square meters in that corner that actually needs it and not the whole field. So it's saving the farmers money, it's saving the environment through not needing to spray whole fields. The data that drones can give is phenomenal, and they are so easy to operate these days. Again, you just need to be cognizant of airspace restrictions or people in the vicinity of an area. In a lot of cases, for agriculture, they're rural areas and very sparsely populated. So it's much easier for a farmer to go buy a drone. So long as he gets the right advice, gets the right drone, you don't want him spending 5,000 euro on a drone that isn't going to give him what the same 5,000 could have given him. But there is obviously a lot more to drones than just the drone itself. The software packages, computing power, are all things that they do need to factor in, that generally there's either going to be a subscription or a piece of software you're going to have to keep paying for to collect and analyze that data. So just looking at the cost of a drone, or the cost of a drone and getting an appropriate license, you do need to consider data as well and technology, because drones collect a lot of data and that storage can build up very, very quickly.
Yeah, they're huge files. We have a little drone at home, one of the DJI ones, and it is bananas when you pair it to a phone. We paired it to a blank phone. There was nothing on the phone, but it fills up so very quickly. So that is good advice. Just in terms of the work that you do and your position, are you optimistic? Are you happy with where we are in terms of the guidance for drone use in Ireland? And are you optimistic and satisfied that Ireland is, or I suppose where Ireland is in terms of its use and its embracing of this technology?
Definitely, in terms of embracing technology, Ireland has been at the forefront for quite some time. There are definitely challenges within the industry. Some of them are out of our hands. Mother Nature has not been kind this year at all, and it's been extremely difficult to operate with the weather. If it's not raining, the wind is particularly strong. So there are definitely challenges to using drones. There are obviously limitations depending on the size of the drone of where it can and can't fly. But there are other challenges, particularly in the commercial side of it, where, as we said at the start, there's a lot of confusion over the regulations, and licensed operators are having a hard time, where in the past they would have operated one way. Transforming into the new European regulations has not proved as simple. I'll give you an example of generally now, if you're a commercial operator in a built-up area, you need a flight termination system and a parachute on that drone. So the flight termination system is to stop the drone flying away. If it leaves where you're meant to be working, you have to kill it. Basically, kill the motors, and the drone then falls to the ground. The parachute is obviously to slow it down and reduce any impact. So these are things that operators are having to add to drones. Bobby Healy obviously has to do the same thing with their drones, because it's quite sizable, and the regulations around getting these things on small drones, it's obviously harder on a smaller drone because it's not as capable of carrying additional weight. But there's also now compliance certification that you have to get a specific parachute for that drone that has been properly tested. In the past, there wasn't the compliance. Now you're having to wait for manufacturers to bring compliance systems onto the market, and them to have the enough capacity to service what is now all of Europe. And the regulations have been coming in across the last number of years. Not every country adopted them straight away. So they're now only getting to a stage where they're having to put parachutes on, but that obviously has an impact on the manufacturers, who are quite small. They're not going to be the size of a DJI, and they only have limited capacity to start now producing certified parachutes for all of Europe. So there are challenges in that. Then the other side of it is the paperwork obviously has to be all in order, and that isn't always as easy as we would like it to be. The regulators obviously need to be cognizant that how you're operating is compliant and in accordance with the regulations. And as we said, the regulations are so long. The quick start guide for the European regulations is 450 pages and growing. So that just tells you that that's not a quick start guide to me, coming from an IT background. But that just tells you the level of complexity in the regulations. So for operators to be compliant, know that they're not breaking the law, it can be very difficult at times.
Yeah, well, look, that has been an incredible guide to drone use in Ireland. I do hope you come back and hopefully answer some of our questions. If you do have questions that you want answered, drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. And hopefully, Fergal, you'll come back in and chat with us again.
I'd be more than happy anytime, Jess.
Now, when we come back here on News Talk, we'll look at the inclusion score that can improve your team's morale.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. As ever, if you want to get in touch with me, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. I'll answer your questions in the next part of the show. So do get them into me, and I will answer as many as I can. I want to give a quick mention to our book club, because Cameron and Kira are going to be back in the week after next to review John Carreyrou's book, Bad Blood, which tells the story of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. We have spoken about Elizabeth Holmes on this program so many times. I personally find her story, her presence in the media, in the tech landscape, utterly fascinating. And John Carreyrou's book is just an incredible tale. It is stranger than fiction. But that is our book club pick. So you've got 2 weeks, well, less than 2 weeks now, really, to read it. I would also recommend the audiobook. It's great. I have been listening to it. I was off last week and I was listening to it again on Audible, and it's just great. It's so captivating from the word go. But if you do read along with us, let me know what you think. Drop me an email, techtalk@newstalk.com. Now, you may remember on this very show a few months back, we were talking about the use of artificial intelligence in HR. So this is something that's been done for quite a while, but AI has been utilized to try and speed up the recruitment process. We focused in on the new legislation that will force companies to ensure that potential employees aren't discriminated against during the recruitment process by any form of technology. And that interview led to an interesting number of emails from listeners to the show around the meaningful implementation of diversity and inclusion policies in the workplace. And I'm delighted to say that Caroline Cummins, who is the director of the Irish Centre for Diversity, is with me now. Caroline, thank you so much for your time. Can you just tell me a little bit about the work that you and your team do, please?
Sure, and thank you for having me on, Jess. I really appreciate it. So the Irish Centre for Diversity are basically an organisation that help businesses across Ireland from all sectors embed equality, diversity, and inclusion into everything they do. And we do that through a number of ways. We do it through our accreditation called Investors in Diversity, which is a framework to help organizations understand where they are, how to improve, and how to measure their improvement. And we also do a huge amount of diversity inclusion training. We've trained about 35,000 people in the last few years, everything from inclusive leadership, inclusive language, LGBTQ plus in the workplace, all the different courses. And we also run Ireland's only national dedicated D&I awards that happens February each year, recognizing excellence across a number of different areas. So pretty much a one-stop shop for all things diversity and inclusion related, Jess.
Yeah, I'm always interested to have these conversations because I think there are still people who, when they hear terms like diversity, equality and inclusion, they'll just roll their eyes or take a big sigh going, you know, that's just box ticking. But we know from research, and there is data there to back it up, that by having a more diverse, inclusive and equal workforce, it is better for your bottom line. We know that it makes teams happier, that they're more well-rounded and your services are better because you're speaking to more customers and so on. So that old way of thinking is very outdated, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think there was, I mean, you know, when we talk about McKinsey and Deloitte reports, sometimes there's more eye rolling because people are like, well, that's a report in the States or somewhere else. But there is a Deloitte report that says if you can increase your inclusion by 10%, you win back a day for every employee. So that just goes, that helps the bottom line. But I think it's really about trying to get everyone in your organization to understand it's not about them or, you know, inclusion is about every single person in the organization. Everyone that comes to work has a different upbringing, background, life experience that shapes who they are as an individual. And inclusion and diversity is about understanding that difference and embracing and being inclusive of it. So diversity is about every person in the organization. So when people roll their eyes at these initiatives and things, well, actually, they're for you too.
Yeah, I still think there's a bit of work to be done. And this is just my own observation in terms of letting people know what is meaningful diversity, inclusion and equality, rather than just text on a page, particularly when it comes to policies in the workplace. Like every company, I'm sure, has a policy, but how do you ensure that it is meaningful and assess that it does cater to real needs and provide real supports?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, policies need to exist and, you know, they need to underpin what an organization is trying to do. But policies alone can't create culture change unless they're lived. I mean, part of our Investors in Diversity framework at the bronze level, we review all the people policies with the D&I lens to look at how inclusive they are. We look at how they're communicated to staff, because just having policies isn't enough. You have to make sure people are aware of them, that they're trained in them. And we also train leaders. But then we, at our silver Investors in Diversity silver level, we run the full staff survey, which is where our inclusion score comes from, where we ask people, do you understand these policies? Do you follow these policies? And sometimes we see organizations that have great policies, they are communicating them. But for some reason, there's a kind of frozen layer because people are saying to us, well, we're not aware of them. We don't follow them. But we're actually going, well, we've seen them. We know you have them. But, you know, it's about how we communicate and understanding that in an organization, everyone is different. And just sending out an email might work for some, but it's not going to work for everyone. So it's about being creative about how you communicate with your employees.
Yeah, I also think there's a bit of work perhaps to be done, and this is just anecdotally, in terms of empowering people and enabling people to evoke the powers and the policies that are in, you know, employee handbooks up and down this country in businesses. Because it's one thing to have the text on the page, but it's another thing to tell people and encourage people to say, you know, I might need extra support, or maybe we need more diverse voices working on X project or Y project and so on. How do we go about doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's about the difference between a policy and a lived and live document. And when we do work with organizations and design or write policies for them, it is about saying to people, if it's in here, then you have to live and breathe it as well. So you need to make sure people that, you know, are aware of it and that they follow it and they know where to go and they know who to talk to. We do get a lot of organizations now that put in place diversity champions. So there's people across the business that are trained and understand, you know, what people can and can't avail of. So if they're unsure, they just go and speak to their D&I champion and say, look, you know, I was hoping to have this support, or I was hoping to have this flexibility, or whatever it might be. Is this something that our business is going to offer? And they're kind of making sure that there's that communication gap doesn't exist then, because obviously they can bring that back to the wider team with questions.
Yeah, and I think, I'm just not trying to just point out all the issues, but I do think sometimes there's an assumption that gender diversity and inclusion only applies to issues of gender and race. But that's not the case. There's a broad spectrum of definitions, I guess, when it comes to these issues. You know, people may need extra supports for dyslexia, for example, or they may have family members who have extra needs, they need greater flexibility. There's more than one definition here.
But if you look at it that, if you think about diversity is about difference, role difference, and diversity includes us all. So if you have people in your organization, you're dealing with diversity. So it's something you have to, consider and take into account about the different sorts of people in your organization, because one size doesn't fit all. Even if you look at, if you have disabled people in your organization, they're not all going to need the same support. So you have to look at each and every individual person and what they might need and what supports they might need. So just writing a policy, a blanket policy, is not going to work. It's about understanding that maybe there needs to be some room and flexibility and changes within that, depending on the needs of the individual within your organization.
And this is something that can help with staff retention, right? Because if people feel like they're seen and they're heard and they're included and they're catered for, they're much more likely to stay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, basic fairness by anyone. I've got two young kids, and from a very young age, that's not fair would come out of their mouth if they didn't get what they want. If people are going into the workplace and not feeling they're getting fair opportunities, fair chances to progress or to be supported or to be themselves within the workplace, why would they want to stay there? They'll go somewhere else. They'll try something else. We spend 8 hours a day in work. A lot of us do. You need to be happy in your workplace. You need to enjoy the time that you have there. So I think it's really important to take that into account, when you're thinking about retaining your workforce as well. We want a happy workforce because a happy workforce will stay.
Yeah, and if companies want to improve their inclusion score or, test the live and breathability of their policies, where do they start and how do they ensure that they are empowering their staff to utilize these policies?
Sure. So our inclusion score is based on the anonymous staff survey to ask people how they feel when they come into work. Do they feel their organization is fair, equitable, and inclusive to them? Do they feel they get opportunities? Do they feel that there are maybe barriers to their career progression because of their age, race, gender, or so on? Or do they get treated differently in a bad way because of their background? And based on the responses of that, we pull together an inclusion score, so on how included people feel within the workplace, on the positive sentiment to those questions. However, it's not just about the score. What we have is a huge amount of opportunity for people to come and to tell us why they feel the way they do. Because obviously, understanding that something's really good or that there's challenges is all well and good. But if we don't understand why, then we don't know how to improve it. So part of it is, yes, we give the organizations their inclusion score, but then one of our D&I consultants will review all the scoring, the data, all the comments to look for themes to understand, kind of why things are the way they are. And then we put together some recommendations and we write an action plan for an organization, in terms of what they need to do to improve. They deliver on that. And that's why we're seeing 100% of our organizations are improving. So, I mean, basically, if you talk to your staff and ask them how they feel, about different areas of inclusion and diversity, and then you feedback to them, this is what we learned and this is what we're going to do with it. And then you do what you say you were going to do. And then you go and ask them again, you will see a more positive response because people will feel heard. And they'll feel that their organization is changing based on their feedback.
Awesome stuff. Look, there is plenty of food for thought there, and I will give out the website in just a quick second. But for the moment, Caroline Cummins, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Jess. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was Caroline Cummins of the Irish Centre for Diversity. Their website has a whole host of information, and supports and guidance and advice as well, which is an excellent resource to have. So again, it is the Irish Centre for Diversity. Now, when we come back here on News Talk, we'll meet the Irish PhD student who has just created a jelly battery.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. In just a few minutes' time, I'm going to answer your tech questions. But before we do, John Fardy is here once again to preview this week's Screen Time. John, what's on the show this week?
Jess, we're doing one of our specials. Tend to do them on bank holidays and stuff like that. I don't know why. That's just the way it's been. We are looking, my esteemed panel, at the best movie twists of all time. And it's going to be great fun, as in the best plot twist of all time.
Give me an example.
Luke, I am your father. Things you didn't see coming, things that really shocked an audience. I don't want to go into them all because,
Can I tell you my one?
Yes, please do.
I don't know if this will be on your list now.
Let's see.
Have you seen Gone Baby Gone?
Yeah. Yeah.
The first time I saw that movie.
It's a good one, all right. Yeah.
It was just a what?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Genuinely, if you'd asked me 100 different potential endings, I wouldn't have picked that one.
Some people found it a bit too unbelievable, but I think it's okay. I'm not sure if that one features in our list, but it is a good one. It absolutely is a good one. The point of a good plot twist, though, is it can't ruin the film, as in it can't be to the point of, oh, come on, you know, the guy was dead all or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
I find that that's an issue that I have with books sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're reading a really good kind of like holiday read that's just chewing gum for the brain, but you're invested in it. And then there's only 60 pages left. And then they're like, and it turns out he was a dog the entire time. And it's almost just to wrap it up and get it done.
That is annoying.
It can be frustrating. So, okay, I'm intrigued.
All of that will be covered in this week's Screen Time.
Awesome stuff, John. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Right, before we get to John, one of my favourite things to do is stumble upon innovators who are using science and technology to develop new solutions and who think entirely different from how the majority of us do. One such person is Stephen O'Neill, who is a PhD student at the University of Cambridge within the Department of Chemistry, who's with me now. Stephen, you're very welcome to the show. Tell me a little bit about what you've been working on.
Yeah, so what we've been trying to do is make soft and stretchy batteries that can match the properties of human brains. And this will allow them to be implanted in the body and really minimize the chances of causing any damage. Because if we think about traditional electronics like our phones or laptops, they're very rigid. So when we try to implant them in the brain, it can cause terrible scarring and inflammation and can start killing neurons or brain cells.
For those who may instantly balk at that idea, can you just explain why we might ever want to put a battery into the brain?
Yes. Yeah, so kind of integrating electronics into the brain can give us a variety of potential applications. So one of the main things that people are working on now is to try and treat brain diseases like Parkinson's or epilepsy. And to do this, we can use something called deep brain stimulation, where we're trying to stimulate parts of the brain that aren't working so well because their neurons are less active. So we can use kind of artificial electrical currents to make these parts of the brain more active, which will help with the symptoms of several brain conditions like Parkinson's or epilepsy.
So this is a medical endeavor rather than just trying to create cyborgs and all the rest, which I'm sure will come at some point. But just tell me about the work that you and your team have done, because as you said, batteries, as we know them when it comes to electronics, they are like they're getting thinner and they're getting smaller, but they're still rigid and they can be a bit cumbersome. There's a whole host of other issues that go alongside this. So just tell me about the work that you've done and how you've gone about it.
Yeah, so your typical batteries use electrodes, which are pretty stiff and rigid. So with our brains are about 60% water, 60 to 70% water. And that's what makes them really squidgy and soft. So if we try and put these rigid batteries in, we get a lot of issues and the body kind of rejects these batteries. So what we tried to do is to match the brain by making something called hydrogels. And these are materials which are also about 60% water. And the other 40% is made up of polymers. So these are long chains of atoms. And these polymers, we've actually made it so they can conduct electricity. So these polymers are charged. And this is what lets them be made into a power source or a battery. And the 60% water is what allows it to be so soft and squidgy and stretchable, almost like the jelly that you'd eat.
Can you just explain that a little bit further? Because again, if we use the phone analogy, people have smartphones, the battery drains. Will this charge itself? And will there be a lifespan as to how many charges it could do?
Yeah, so this will, sadly, it will not self-charge. So to charge this battery, we will actually need to use another battery that will then recharge the battery. So this is something that definitely needs to be looked into for future work, is how many cycles it can go of discharging and recharging. And currently we can get about 0.1 volts, which is a lot less than your battery you can buy in the shop, for example. So this is also a key thing, is to try and increase this power and voltage of these batteries.
You mentioned the importance of the makeup of your battery, so the consistency of the jelly and the water and all the rest. Is this something that can like be utilized on a long-term basis? And I fully acknowledge and own the fact that I'm not a scientific person, so this could be a stupid question, but I suppose once it's in, is it in? Or what way does that work?
And how much, or how intrusive, I suppose, how intrusive would this be on both the body and the brain?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I guess these batteries will have to be implanted in the brain. And then to be able to recharge it, you'll have to use, you can either potentially wirelessly recharge it through wireless power transfer, or you'd have to use wires and recharge it in the brain. Ideally, once it's in, and you won't have to constantly kind of take it out and put it back in. But the ways to recharge it will definitely be a key milestone in applying these batteries in the brain.
The achievement of getting the consistency that you have is incredible. Can you just tell us a little bit about how long you've been working on this and the previous iterations of it, as well as like what you've learned and how you've learned from those different iterations along the way?
Yeah, so I've been working on this project for about 3 years now. And yeah, a big part of this was trying to make the materials soft and stretchy and be able to conduct electricity without them becoming very stiff and rigid, because we want to keep them soft so that they can be just like the brain. So that was kind of one of the main challenges. And then another challenge was just designing the power source. So the way the power source works is it's actually inspired by electric eels, whereby electric eels are able to create electricity because they have different compartments of salts in their cells. So they have some compartments with very high amounts of salts and some compartments with very low amounts of salts. And these salts can be just like sodium chloride, like your common table salt. And when we have a high amount of salt and a low amount of salt, the salts actually naturally start flowing from the high to the low in a process that's called diffusion. So if we put something in between these two high and low compartments of salts that will only let the positive salts through. So for example, in sodium chloride table salt, you have sodium, which is positive, and chloride is negative. Then we get this difference in charge where the sodium builds up on one side, so the positive part. And this positive buildup on one side is actually what causes this voltage or this energy. So trying to mimic electric eels and get this process to work was one of the main challenges in this work. And now it is working well. So that was a nice inspiration from electric eels, and we're getting a voltage across our battery.
That is an incredible achievement. So what's next then, you know, from an academic point of view, what's the next step to kind of kick this on and test it out further?
Yeah, the next step would really be to confirm that they are biocompatible. So at the moment, we know we've tested these materials with cells. We can grow brain cells on these materials, but we haven't actually put it inside an animal's brain yet. So the next step would be to put these power sources in animals' brains and monitor the animals and make sure that they're okay.
Well, look, it is fascinating research. And as you've outlined, it has the potential to transform the lives of people living with certain conditions. So we wish you the best of luck. And hopefully we'll check in with you as you reach the next milestone in your research.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, that was Stephen O'Neill, who is a PhD student at the University of Cambridge. I adore hearing the innovation and the research like that. It just makes my heart happy. But that is it from me this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.